The next case is 55121, Tri-County Equipment versus Clink. Mr. Glovac for the appellant, Mr. Kilpatrick for the respondent.
Please, the court, counsel. I'm Scott Glogovac, attorney for the appellant in this action, Tri-County Equipment and Leasing. With the permission of the court, I'd like to reserve a few minutes of my time for rebuttal if it works out that way. This case presents an issue of first impression in Nevada and an issue that is of great importance to the parties and insurers that are involved in personal injury actions in this state. And the issue is, what do we do procedurally in a situation where an injured plaintiff's medical expenses have sets of numbers? One number is the actual paid amount of medical expenses, and the second number is the original billed amount of expenses. What procedurally does a trial court do in a situation like that, and what substantively is the plaintiff's right of recovery? So from a procedural standpoint, the question is, what comes into evidence? Is the evidence the actual paid amount of the bills, or is the evidence the original billed amount of the bills, or is it both?
And we understand that issue. That's what the case is about. But what's our standard of review, Mr. Glogovac, on that issue?
Standard of review should be de novo.
Well, in your opening brief, I'm calling to page 8, you say that Nevada Supreme Court reviews a decision to admit or to exclude evidence for an abuse of discretion. So you framed it up as an abuse of discretion standard.
Right, but I think it's also a substantive recovery issue. And that's really why I'm glad we have oral argument in this case, because I want to, if I can, redirect it to what really is the issue in this case. I know there, Your Honor, there was a lot of talk about workman's compensation statutes and whether the California work comp file should come into evidence under Nevada statutes. But the real issue here is how to treat those medical bills at trial. What is the substantive right of recovery of a plaintiff? I think that's really what's at play in this case.
Well, if I understand it correct, and please tell me if I'm wrong, okay, it's California workers' comp. If it's Nevada workers' comp, I probably wouldn't be here because we have the statute here that's specific to Nevada. But it's California. Our research indicates the California Court of Appeals are split on this issue of if it's admissible or not, which number is admissible, and that the California, it may be awaiting a decision from the California Supreme Court, but they haven't ruled. So we have conflicting authorities in California from the Intermediate Court of Appeals. So Judge Russell chose to say that it was the bill number that comes in through the motion in limine. So based upon that, that's what makes me think, is it an abuse of discretion here? I don't know how you argued it, and is that how we have to look at it?
No, going back to, first of all, with respect to the California cases, the cases that you're referencing didn't come up in the workers' compensation context. They came up more in the context of where you had providers. I think one of the cases may have been a government assistance program. One of the cases may have been private coverage, private insurance. Mm-hmm. There are three California cases that can actually be cited on this issue, and all three of those cases come down on the side of the plaintiff's recovery being limited to the actual paid amount as opposed to the plaintiff's recovery being the actual paid amount as opposed to the recovery being the original billed amount. The two cases that go the other way in California have both been decertified and can't be cited. One is the Howell case, and that is the case that's before the California Supreme Court. And my understanding is that it might not be till 2012 that the California Supreme Court actually issues a ruling in that case. I think what Judge Russell did here, I've just read the transcript, I wasn't trial counsel, but it looked to me like Judge Russell took the position that because this was a California workers' compensation case, it doesn't fit within the exception to the collateral source rule under Nevada law for work comp to come in. So he ruled that our position, that it didn't matter which state's workman's compensation was involved, it needed to be a Nevada work comp case to come into evidence. That was his first ruling. But then beyond that, and to me the more troubling ruling in this case is that he held repeatedly, because the issue was raised repeatedly, is that the collateral source rule prevents a defendant, or I guess the collateral source rule allows a plaintiff, stated betterly, to recover the original billed amount as opposed to the actually paid amount. And the idea there is, although he didn't articulate it this way, but the cases that hold that, their idea is this. The collateral source rule is a rule that says that if an injured plaintiff receives a benefit from any source independent of the tortfeasor, then the tortfeasor can't use that benefit to reduce his or her liability to the injured plaintiff. That's Nevada law. And I think I would concede it's not only a rule of evidence, but it is a substantive rule of damages. So the question becomes, is a physician write-down or is a provider discount, is that a benefit afforded to an injured plaintiff by a third party who's independent of the tortfeasor?
Let me ask you this. Didn't Judge Russell, and correct me if I'm wrong, say under Proctor versus Castelletti that the actual payments are not admissible, you know, what they receive, the billing is, the payments are not. Therefore, although we have the statute on workers' comp here, it's not implicated because it's California's workers' comp. Ergo, based on Proctor versus Castelletti, I'm going to just let in the what was billed here like that. That's kind of the gist I got out of it.
No, you have the correct gist, Your Honor.
Okay.
So what I'm getting to is how do you justify that? Because ordinarily we think of a collateral source benefit to an injured plaintiff being something like disability payments, perhaps a gift from others, or a tortfeasor defendant outside of whatever coverage that tortfeasor defendant has conveys a benefit on the plaintiff, those sorts of things. Now we're getting into the issue of does collateral source the benefit that's envisioned by that rule include a provider discount or a pay down, a write down? And I think that if we extend the collateral source rule to that kind of gap in the bills, what we do is we really just disregard what's going on in the real world everywhere. It's not as if there, in just the occasional case, there's going to be a difference between what the plaintiff's actual paid bills are and what the billed amounts are. It's not like that's a rarity. Let's face it, we live in an era of managed care and controlled medical costs. Just think about all of the kind of managed care and controlled medical cost situations we have. Medicare, Medicaid, work comp, other government assistance programs, and then private insurance, same thing that the government programs do, which is go into providers and negotiate discounts and reductions. If somebody has need for radiological services and they go to Carson Tahoe Hospital in this town, they'll see a radiological group, a doctor there that has a contract with the hospital, but then contracts with the medical provider or with the insurance companies to do the work. And those are all subject to discounts and controlled
prices. But isn't that a legislative issue? Couldn't the Nevada legislature, when they adopted the statute as it pertains to Nevada workers' comp, couldn't say it applies to all workers' comp claims, regardless of what state, if it's Nevada litigation? And then that would have answered the question. Aren't you asking us to create legislation here by that?
No, I'm not. Nevada has a common law collateral source rule. There are states that have collateral source statutes, and some of the cases that the parties have cited in their briefs cite to decisions from those states. But no, this is a collateral source case, not a work comp case. I think.
And at the end, there was a motion to set off the amount of the discount, obviating the potential issue under the collateral source rule of introducing evidence under the collateral source rule.
Right.
And in your brief, you set out that is a pure de novo review question. Could you address the set-off issue as a way of managing the collateral source rule as an evidentiary rule at trial as opposed to a substantive rule?
Yeah, and if I could just preliminarily, Judge, I don't even think that the rule that I'm advocating here runs afoul of the collateral source rule. The plaintiff puts a number in just like they always have in personal injury cases, only the number is the actual paid number. But if there is some concern that actual paid numbers creates a conflict with the collateral source rule, yeah. I mean, then what can happen is exactly what happened in this case and what goes on in California where it's allowed. After trial, the court receives evidence holds a hearing and receives evidence from the parties as to whether or not there is a difference. and tries to come to an understanding as to whether or not there is a lower actual paid number versus the original billed number.
And that was teed up in this case?
Yes, it was. There was a motion to reduce jury verdict, and it was actually heard in open court. Judge Russell denied it, standing on his previous view that the collateral source rule prevents this from occurring. And that's where we really have the difference with the judge in this case, not so much over the work comp part of it, because we can take this issue out of the work comp context and tee it up, to use your language, Your Honor, and you have a situation that happens all the time. People receive care through managed care programs, government assistance programs, and it's really the norm. So what happens is if we don't pursue the approach that we're recommending in this case or suggesting in this case, we really have two universes. What happens out there in the real world of what people pay for medical bills and what lawyers get to do in the courtroom. And I just don't think that's something we want to promote in personal injuries in this case, particularly given the fact that tort damages are tied to actual harm to the plaintiff.
Mr. Goh, let me ask one other question. I know you can reserve some time. Now, in the respondent's answering brief, page 2, they say that the record does not establish what the amount of the write-downs are, so therefore it's improper to consider right. it at any time, including post-trial. What's your position on that?
That in our reply brief, great lengths were gone to point to why we were, yes, in fact, we had done incorrect calculations in the opening brief. The number was actually greater, and there are specific record citations, Your Honor, in the reply brief to the portions of the workers' comp file that was not admitted into evidence that show what billed amounts were and what the paid amounts were. So it is in the record. What happened here, Your Honor, is the evidence that we wanted to offer at trial that really kind of underlies all this was a workers' compensation file. For the plaintiff. She worked at Starbucks. She was injured in the course and scope of her employment. Starbucks managed her care. The work comp file was offered as an exhibit. It contained all of the numbers, billed amounts, paid amounts. A series of explanations of benefits are part of that exhibit. It was trial exhibit 30, and those explanations of benefits show billed amounts and paid amounts. And the discrepancy, the awarded amount was $17,510. The actual paid amount was around $8,900. So the record does have factual support for this issue. It's procedurally supported, and as Justice Pickering pointed out, the standard of review is appropriate as to the way it's procedurally postured.
You have about 2.5 minutes left. You want to say that?
If I may, Your Honor, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Morning. Charlie Kilpatrick for the respondent, Angela Bolentini, and I tried this case not far from here. The issue is this collateral source provider write-offs, and the case law all over the country is absolutely unanimous that the provider write-off is a collateral source benefit subject to the collateral source rule. It's absolutely unanimous. There's only two types of cases out there. One's a collateral source rule, like Nevada has, that says that has a substantive and an evidentiary component. And Mr. Glogovac doesn't dispute that. He stated that too. The substantive component is there's a lot of Nevada authority on it saying we can't reduce the jury verdict because a plaintiff received a collateral source benefit.
Well, Mr. Kilpatrick, I know we did our own research, right, too, on that, and we found a case called Martinez versus Milburn Enterprises. It's a June 2010 Kansas Supreme Court case, which basically says that both the actual amount billed and the actual amount paid is admissible. So it's kind of a different rule. It says both of it comes right in, and then the jury can, you know, make its own conclusion on what the fair value is. So there is some split on the authority on the either it's none of it comes in, all of it comes in, well, or just the billed amount comes
right,
in.
Right, but not on the substantive part that the provider write-off is a collateral source benefit. That one Kansas case is the only one that. Hedges on the per se, what we have in Nevada, the per se collateral source evidentiary component. But at trial, the jury here is instructed with a pattern jury instruction without objection from defense counsel, returns a verdict for whatever the amount was, $17,000-something in medical bills. The failure to recognize that none of the courts are getting into this. They don't want to distinguish between Plaintiff A, who has auto med pay that pays $5,000. There's no issue raised then in this case because of that. Plaintiff B has TRICARE that's the gold standard that pays the whole $5,000 but has subrogation rights. Plaintiff C is probably most common, which is they're receiving a combination of direct payments and provider write-offs. Either way, the bill has been satisfied by a collateral source. Billed and paid by a collateral source.
Now, do you think this is a legislative issue? Mr. Glogovac didn't
think
so.
Well, it definitely is, because the only states that are adverse are the ones that have the collateral source statutes. Those are the only ones, and those cases still hold unanimously that the provider write-offs are a collateral source. The only difference is, in those cases, the insurance defense lawyers want it to be a collateral source because they're written off under the state statute. In this case, they don't want it to be a collateral source because the plaintiff gets the benefit of the billed amount.
But wouldn't the amount of the discount then, under your theory, amount to a double recovery?
No. The plaintiff has, all collateral source payments amount to a double recovery in some sense. In other words, if the auto med pay pays $5,000, there's no issue here in this court. Now they've had a double recovery. They get to recover that $5,000 from the tortfeasor, and the bill is paid. Under our scenario here, it's the exact same situation. We get to recover the $5,000 from the tortfeasor, and the bill is paid. The only difference is it's paid partly with provider discounts, provider write-offs, and partly with a cash payment. But all the cases unanimously across this country, whether they're collateral source statutes or common law collateral source states like Nevada, say that provider write-off is just a collateral source benefit because the person has, there's procurement costs and there are subrogation liens. Both of those cut into the argument that there's a windfall to the plaintiff. And most of all the cases considering it, I think, have said if there's going to be a windfall, it's not going to be to the defendant who happens to run into somebody who's got great insurance. And here there's really no difference. The bill has been, there's talk about, it was never incurred, nobody had any liability. Baloney. It was billed and paid. That's incurred, billed and paid. And it was satisfied through a combination. And like I say, all the cases, if there's one thing that is completely well established, it is that provider write-offs are a collateral source benefit subject to the collateral source rule. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Anything else I can address?
Justice Gibbons, anything else?
What about the calculations in this Exhibit 30? Your position on that?
When you're seeing new calculations in the reply brief, then you've basically had a concession that the information provided to the trial court was inadequate, and they admitted that. They provided that same exhibit. If you look at that exhibit, you say, how could you ever claim write-offs or pay-downs based on this? And it falls right with is the interesting thing is all three of the issues raised by the defense have direct Nevada authority contrary. You know, you have Kramer v. Peavy, limited exception to the collateral source rule on the work foreign state work comp. We could have one from Arkansas. We have the collateral source rule, Proctor v. Castelletti, directly on point. And we have all these cases in Nevada that say you can't reduce the jury verdict because a plaintiff received a collateral source benefit. And it's not even disputed that this is a collateral source benefit because it's a real-world combination of benefits provided by the work comp insurer. That company received insurance premiums, and they have subrogation rights. So that cuts against the double recovery.
To the extent the collateral source rule issue in this case is one of substantive law, do you agree that it's a de novo review standard for the court?
Yes, yes. And I cited the Nevada cases that that do hold that the underlying rationale is for the collateral source rule is we're not gonna reduce a plaintiff's verdict. It's hard enough to get a plaintiff's verdict in this town, but because she received collateral source benefits, and we definitely don't want to have the trial judges picking and choosing so that the one who has the combination of the PPO with the payment and the write-off gets penalized, while the person who has auto med pay that just pays the bill or pays it themselves, they get to collect the full amount from the tortfeasor. It doesn't make any sense. And that's why Oregon says the vast majority of states, well, the vast majority means all of them except this evidentiary issue in Kansas and a Louisiana appellate court. There is no state Supreme Courts that there's except one Louisiana appellate decision. The at the time of trial, the defendant cited these Virginia federal district court cases that were then overruled, and that comes in the second supplemental reply brief from the defendants. And it's only a 2001 case. Now, I don't know how you can have a 2000 federal district court case and cite that as authority when there's a 2001 state Supreme Court case overruling it. I mean, how do you not get that?
You know? What would you do with deliberately inflated provider billings? Assuming, I'm not saying
that
we're in this case at all, but
that's easy. In this case, both sides presented expert testimony as to what bills were reasonable and necessary, reasonable in amount, necessarily incurred for the care, treatment, or diagnosis of the injuries in the accident. So the jury cut the damages off at some point. If you looked at special verdict here, they said, okay, we'll give you this, 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 and this, but this treatment you got, this chiropractic treatment down the road, we're not giving you that. So anyway, the evidence can be adduced by at the time of trial as to which bills are reasonable in amount and necessary, you know, causally related, necessary for the care, treatment, or diagnosis. So all you need is to present a witness that says, no, the prevailing, you know, that $2,000 for that MRI is excessive. And we see that kind of testimony all the time in chiropractic care, where they will have
I'm not talking about the reasonableness of the care, but rather the reasonableness of the price. And ultimately, what a willing buyer and a willing seller pay from a contract standpoint.
Oh, reasonable amount. Yes, yeah. We see that all the time where the insurance defense attorneys hire experts. They come in and say, the cost of this care was greatly inflated. For instance, you can have a treat and release at Renown Medical Center that could cost you $25,000, and you've just been care flighted over there, and you have a treat and release. Well, sure, the bills, the providers are going to testify, yes, our bill is reasonable, that's the prevailing rate, but there is certainly the opportunity for the defense if bills are excessive. Ordinarily, the billed amount, no one in this case said any of the billed amounts were excessive, and ordinarily, that's not the issue because they're billed and, you know, billed and paid, but long before you get to trial, these bills are all paid, and that was the case here.
Thank you. Mr. Kogovec, you have about 2 minutes and 48 seconds.
Thank you. Just to quickly respond to a few things Mr. Kilpatrick said, I thought I heard him first say that the case law is unanimous that this is a, and I wrote this down, that this is a collateral source, and I think he was referring to provider discounts or write-downs. He's wrong. The case law is not unanimous on that, which is why at the outset I discussed with Justice Gibbons what has gone on in California. Mr. Kilpatrick backtracked a little bit and talked about some other cases that don't say what he initially said all of the cases say. He also indicated that it's not disputed that this is a collateral source, and I would say that's the very nature of the dispute that we have here today.
He indicated that there's a lot of Nevada cases on point that render this indisputable. What I will say is, yes, there are multiple Nevada cases that uphold the collateral source rule, both as a rule of evidence and as a rule of substantive recovery. However, none of the Nevada collateral source rule cases have touched on this issue, which brings us here today, and that is, can we characterize provider discounts, which are just inherent in the system now, because managed care has taken over medical care here, pervasive through government programs, private programs, can we say that the discounts that are inherent in the system are a collateral source to a plaintiff? And that's the issue that we're asking this court to touch upon. Then if this court agrees with some of the authorities that have said that is not a collateral source, then the issue is, how do we handle it? And that kind of goes to Justice Pickering's last question, which is, what do you do at trial where you have the inflated bill situation? And that is a concern, because if you have these two worlds that I talked about in my opening remarks, you have physicians whose staff takes, they take initial input from patients, was it a car accident, and is their insurance? And what that allows a provider to do is say, wow, this is a potential personal injury case. I'm going to charge what I want to charge here, not what I know I get from the healthcare system. I'm going to charge what I want to charge. Those are the bills that are going to go into evidence. In the meantime, I'm going to pocket the provider amount that I get and that I collect routinely in my practice. And when the trial's all over, I'm going to sit down with plaintiff lawyers and we're going to divide up the excess that was awarded. I mean, you really kind of create that kind of two-world system.
If I can ask you this, I mean, I understand your argument from an equitable standpoint, but at least two of us were trial judges here in the state court. Justice Pickering had extensive litigation experience. Proctor versus Castellate says it shall not be considered. I mean, that's a blanket ban. Then the legislature did this carve-out under Nevada workers' comp for Nevada workers' comp. There is no carve-out for California or any other state. So that's why I'm asking, isn't this legislating, this exception you're asking us to create?
No, it's not an exception. What I'm asking, Your Honor, is this court to recognize that the collateral source rule, as it exists, doesn't extend to it. This falls outside the rule. We're not asking this court to create an inroad into the collateral source rule. What we're asking this court to do is to recognize that provider discounts, which are pervasive in the system, aren't a collateral source.
Aren't they? But doesn't Proctor versus Castelletti address that?
No, it does not, Your Honor. Proctor versus Castelletti wasn't a provider discount case. It simply stands for the proposition that collateral source evidence doesn't come in. And I think also you have to infer a substantive damage rule in there. So this is conceptually, what do you overlay the collateral source rule on? There are certain things we don't disagree on that would be collateral sources, disability benefits, etc. But write-downs that are part of the medical compensation system in this country pervasively, how can that be considered a collateral source? Something that isn't paid is a collateral source.
Well, Mr. Govek, as I recall, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I think when Coden was adopted by the voters on medical malpractice cases, they created a new rule in Coden on collateral source. I believe it's part of the whole package of legislation on the caps of damages. So that was legislatively created on med mal cases. The Kramer case interprets the statute legislatively created. So I don't know. I mean, I'm going to reread Proctor versus Kane. I read it yesterday, but I'm going to reread it. But I thought it was a complete blanket.
Yeah, it's a per se collateral source rule. No question, Your Honor. Again, what do you overlay it on? Does it include discounts?
Okay, I understand.
Thank you
very
much. I
have one more question, ma'am.
Well, yeah, absolutely, Justice Pickering.
Mr. Kilpatrick made an interesting argument that the plaintiff who pays for gold standard insurance is paying more out of pocket for that insurance, so he'll perhaps have access to a wider range of doctors and less contentious coverage, and that should be treated then as part of the collateral source rule, because whatever his insurer can negotiate for the finest medical care is something the plaintiff actually paid for in the premiums to the insurance company. I'm not doing justice to his argument, but that's essentially what I heard him saying. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, two things quickly, Your Honor. One is it's really a fortuity argument. And I don't mean to sound, you know, callous about this, but there's fortuity all the time in terms of who a tortfeasor defendant harms. a tortfeasor defendant could harm a 39-year-old neurosurgeon, or a tortfeasor could harm somebody who's unfortunately been out of work for 2 years. I mean, there's fortuity in what kind of coverage a plaintiff happens to have. It just goes back to the general notion that plaintiffs are taken as you find them. That's just a fortuity in the system. It doesn't mean that rises to the level that we then disregard our fundamental jurisprudence, which is that tort damages are designed to make people whole, to compensate them for their actual damages. I think that's the main comment that I would have in response to that. Also, it kind of comes out in the wash anyway, Your Honor, because the uninsured person is going to be getting treatment on liens, and those liens are going to have to be paid out. The injured person, who really ought to be the focus here, ends up in the same position either way. The injured person with no insurance still has to pay the bills. It may be the inflated bills, but that person still has to pay them. The insured person pays the discounted bills. The general damages and the other numbers theoretically remain the same. So I understand what Mr. Kilpatrick's saying, but again, it's no reason to abandon our jurisprudence on damages, and also to expand the collateral source to something that isn't happening as opposed to something that did happen.
Well, thank you to both counsel in this matter. When I noticed who was going to argue, I knew it was going to be a good argument, and you lived up to my expectations, both of you. So this matter will stand submitted. Very interesting issues you've raised.
We get to keep going back and forth. I have a lot more things to say. This appellate work can get